Water so deep you could swim a horse. I'm David James, and next on 2 Main Street, looking back on the Easter Sunday storm that swept across the country's heartland. My guest is Nancy Germano, author of the new book, Indiana and the Great Flood of 1913. It was a flood preceded by deadly tornadoes, and the carnage left behind included devastated communities, homeless families huddled on high ground, and drowned elephants, lions, and tigers at a circus compound. There are tales of rescues and desperate attempts to free those trapped by the raging floodwaters. And we learned how land development made the flooding even worse. And how Evansville newspaper readers were encouraged to bounce back from the flood by joining the Smile Club. 2 Main Street is next, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. From the WNIN Tri-State Public Media Center in downtown Evansville, I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street on the banks of the Ohio River. River lore is part of the Hoosier DNA. Settlers put down their roots along the Wabash, White, Maumee, and other rivers. They shipped and received their goods on the water, first on flatboats, then steamboats, later on barges. Rivers are the arteries of Indiana, and when there's a flood, the whole state bleeds. The founder of the Red Cross, Clara Barton, the angel of the battlefield in the Civil War, brought her new organization to Evansville during the 1884 flood, when the Ohio River crested at 47 feet, putting Evansville in the national spotlight with her dispatches to major newspapers to promote the work of the new Red Cross. Decades later, in 1913, the Ohio flooded again, just 1 year after the death of Clara Barton. Easter Sunday, 1913, marked a series of natural disasters, deadly tornadoes followed by deadly flooding, and stories of hardship, courage, and determination, all included in the new book, Indiana and the Great Flood of 1913. The author is my guest, Nancy Germano, an instructor of history at Butler University, who earned her doctorate degree with her research on flooding and environmental history in the Midwest. She got her degree, I guess, from IU, is that right?
That's
your
right.
Doctorate degree. Nancy Germano, welcome to 2 Main Street, and where the Ohio River is just across the street from us.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, we love to talk history here at 2 Main Street. I'm really a history geek. Now, a flood wall is in place right now in downtown Evansville, but not in 13. The river actually flooded into the downtown area. And, of course, that was the scene all across Indiana in 1913.
So, yeah, in the book, I cover the entire state, basically. I'm from Indianapolis, and so that's how I first learned about the 1913 flood, doing a little history project, and learned that the 1913 flood had created quite a bit of chaos in Indianapolis. But then with this book, I've done more research and learned that it really was across the state, from Evansville on the bank of the Ohio River all the way up to Fort Wayne that's situated on three rivers. So this was quite a devastating flood, but it's tucked away in the annals of history, if you will, and a lot of people don't know about it. They're really surprised to learn that there was a 1913 flood in Indiana.
I think we're all aware of the 1937 flood.
That's right.
But the 1913 flood, as readers can find out in this book, it really was encompassing the whole state, and the losses and monetary losses and human losses, incredible. Now, take us back in time to what became a perfect storm in March of 1913. It started with twisters in the plains, is that right?
Right. Started out in Nebraska and kind of marched its way across the Midwest and entered the state around Terre Haute, Indiana, as a tornado, and killed 17 people, that tornado. But then the tornado was followed by torrential rains and a lot of flooding as well. So an additional four people lost their lives in Terre Haute because of the floodwaters. But yes, it didn't stop there. It continued on across the state.
course, Terre Haute means high land.
Right.
So, if you weren't on the high land, I guess you were in trouble.
That's right. And actually, the city became an island around the courthouse in the center of the city. And that's where everyone ran to be on the highest ground in order to escape the water.
Now, along with the twisters, as you mentioned, came the drenching rains. Now, in your book, there's a chart of the rainfall in communities across the state. And I think nearby Vincennes received over 9 inches of rain in a three-day period. And some of these communities were like almost a foot of rain.
Yeah, that's right. And then in other places, it was only 6 inches of rain. And so that then raises the question of, you know, why? Why 6 inches of rain can cause so much devastation in one place, and yet, you know, it takes 9 inches or 12 inches in other places. And so, yeah, you just have to really look at the conditions and the specifics of each place.
So the topography certainly played a major role in this. And I know you go through that in your book as well, how the landscape of Indiana.
That's right.
Crisscrossed by rivers.
That's right. And, you know, the bed of ancient lakes and lots of swampland to begin with. So, you know, when the state of Indiana was first formed back in the early 1800s, they were looking at swampland everywhere. And so, you know, in order to develop and create farmland and places, cities and homes and so forth, they undertook some pretty drastic changes to the landscape, including draining lakes and draining swamplands, cutting ditches in order to drain fields so they could plant crops, and building levees along rivers to try to keep those rivers within their banks. And so all of those modifications over the years just kept, you know, building up and building up until we had some, you know, a major disaster in like 1913 and then again in 1937.
Now, I think you have in the back of your book, a natural disaster tied to human action. The rain finally stops. The rivers and streams start to rise, isolating communities. And you put in your book, are there urgent calls for help?
That's right. Yeah, certainly to the governor of Indiana, but also President Woodrow Wilson. And Indiana was not the only place affected by the 1913. As I said, it started in Nebraska and moved across, continued on past Indiana into Ohio as well. So it became a natural, natural in quotation marks,
right,
if you will, disaster that caught the attention across the country, including the president. And yes, so the American Red Cross was put into action, National Guard troops put into action, as well as Army personnel. So,
now, there were refugee camps that were set up around Indiana, and were they manned by the local communities or the national people come in?
I think the local communities were making arrangements, you know, forming committees to figure out what was needed, what could they do to help, looking at what sort of supplies, food and bedding and so forth that these refugees would need, cots. And I do know that Fort Benjamin Harrison in Indianapolis, which would have been, you know, National Army, supplied a lot of cots and blankets and that sort of thing to help out people. But yeah, there were a lot of refugees, and then looking at the conditions in these refugee camps, where there was, you know, along with this water, and in the middle of March or towards the end of March, so cold conditions, they had lost electricity, water was not drinkable, became very dire conditions for them, and disease was also a real concern in these refugee camps. And so they did bring in national medical teams to help get people vaccinated against typhoid and malaria and these other types of diseases that were circulating in these refugee camps.
And also churches became places for people gathered, and schools and courthouses, and they would all congregate in these one locations and, mm-hmm. because they were forced from their homes.
That's right. That's right. It had to be a really scary disaster to go through. Many people became homeless. They estimated in Indiana around 200,000 people became homeless mm-hmm. because of this flood.
One news report called the southwestern corner of the state a sea of water. And there was one report in your book about a night watchman in Evansville fired shots and rang the church bell to warn residents in neighborhoods that the new levee had been deliberately cut to avoid even more damage and a certain loss of life. So can you imagine these people hearing this shots in the air and find out what's going on, and then we're cutting the levee and it's going to be more water coming to the neighborhood. Right. That'd be frightening moments.
Yes, definitely. And so a lot of these communities, like Evansville, along rivers that tended to flood, had these emergency preparedness plans. We think, you know, we have our modern day emergency preparedness plans, but they had them back then too, but it might have just been a shot in the air or ringing the church bell. Mm-hmm. But yes.
The Ohio River at Evansville finally crested, I think, on April 5th at just over 48 feet. So, of course, Indiana, an agrarian society at that time at the turn of the century, farmers, of course, lost cropland and, of course, livestock as well. Mm-hmm. That had to be a major loss to the state.
That's right. So there are reports of, and photographs that I found in old newspapers of, you know, fields where cattle had been drowned in the water. And farmers talked about having their fields just strewn with gravel and silt and the good topsoil sure. scraped off. So, I'm more of an urban historian, but certainly wanted to acknowledge the plight of the farmers in this disaster as well.
Now, my guest is Nancy Germano. She's the author of Indiana and the Great Flood of 1913. Now, before we take a tour of the state to hear stories of survival and tragic losses, let's talk more about the Hoosier landscape crisscrossed by rivers. And, of course, in the early history of Indiana, the Wabash and Erie Canal bankrupted the state. And did that hurt future flood control efforts? They didn't want to invest any more money?
Well, I suspect it did, because Indiana then passed a law after that bankruptcy that they would no longer go into debt. It was illegal for the state to go into debt. And so, any major projects to try to control flooding would have been included and affected by that.
So. It's interesting that Wabash and Erie Canal ended here in Evansville.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And right here, our old courthouse, on one of the streets there was where the canal was. And it didn't, I think, did the railroads kill that?
Well, yes, in part. There were a couple of things that killed the canal, but yes, railroads were, you know, nipping at its heels, if you will, and, became much more efficient way of transportation than the canals ever could. But there were so many problems with the canal as well, building the banks properly so that the water didn't seep out. And there's so many interesting stories of, maiden tours or trips on the canal that didn't quite pan out the way they hoped because the canal was leaking water.
Now, you said you study the urban landscape a lot. Indianapolis, the founding of Indianapolis as a state capital is an interesting story as well. After they decided to build a state capital there, they looked at all the problems that they ran into with the rivers and the swampland.
That's right. Right. So, the capital was originally in southern Indiana, but they wanted to move it to the center of the state where it would, be a better, more central location. when the commissioners went looking for this site, they happened to be there on a dry year, so they didn't realize quite how many drainage problems they were going to encounter trying to build a city here in this flat land. But they were excited about the flat land coming from the south and the hilly land. They thought, great, we can easily build homes and city structures here. But it was flat. Along with flat land goes the fact that drainage is a problem. Right. So, there's no grade for this water to drain off. And it was crisscrossed by several creeks and runs and swampland and a very, very muddy location. Along with that problem was the fact that White River turned out not to be navigable. So this location was quite a disappointment once they realized all of these things, but they continued to proceed with, it's still a good central location, right? And by then they'd already invested in building this city to some extent and continued on with it. But because the river wasn't navigable, I think people lost respect for it and decided to use it for other purposes, which was ideal for a city growing along the banks of the river. They could use it for waste disposal. They could, build industry there and dump industrial waste into the river. And so the river just became this dumping ground, really. And people, that relationship with the river really changed. It was no longer a means of profit or commerce and transport. It just became this river that they could dump into, and then it would flood and cause more problems for them, right? So they had this really contentious relationship with the river.
So in 1913, when the White River flooded, that was a mess.
That's right. Right. So along with the water.
All the waste in that.
Yes. Human waste, industrial waste, trash, everything you can imagine was in this water.
And the cleanup had to be incredible after the flood.
Yes. Yes. Some of the descriptions from people who experienced it in the archives talk about, just this slimy, muddy mess on everything. And so one measure to try to offset that and avoid disease was, sprinkling lime on everything. So lime was a big commodity at the time to try to kill off disease.
I can just imagine shoveling this stuff off the streets. And
How about your porch or your living room carpet, right?
Sure, definitely. Now, coming up, we're going to talk about some of the rescue attempts, overturned boats, babies born, people clinging to trees, camped out on their attics, and the desperate attempt to save children at a flooded orphanage, and elephants, lions, and tigers caught in a flash flood in Peru, Indiana, which was the winter home of the circus. A lot more to come with my guest, Nancy Germano, author of the New History Press book, Indiana and the Great Flood of 1913. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James. My guest is Dr. Nancy Germano, history professor at Butler University and author of the new History Press book, Indiana and the Great Flood of 1913. Now, we've talked about how this perfect storm roared across the midsection of the country, starting Easter Sunday, tornadoes, then the devastating flooding. A lot of facts and figures in the book about the monetary losses, but you also share the gripping human stories of death and survival. Now, one quote I like from this Hoosier was, "Water so deep it could swim a horse." Nancy, that's pretty graphic.
Yes, it is. One of those Hoosierisms, if you will, right? And they were talking about in Indianapolis, right? In the middle of the capital city, ravines were part of the natural topography that was there before modifications. And when the White River and Pogues Run and Fall Creek and all of these other water sources in the capital city overtopped their banks. The water was deep enough for, I mean, you can imagine, I don't know how tall a horse is. There's certain hands that measure a horse's height. But, deep enough for a horse to be able to swim, wow. Lift his feet right off the ground, right?
Now, you have this one story in your book that really affected me, and I could kind of visualize this. The desperate attempts to save children at an orphanage, was that in Fort Wayne?
That's right. Right. So that was, a very, very sad story that came out of the flood. And there are so many stories of deaths that occurred, drownings, and then rescue attempts that go bad. And this was probably the most heartbreaking, where there were an orphanage, a county home, mm-hmm. As they called it. So orphans that had been caught in the county home by the river flooding, and as they were trying to rescue them, they actually had them into a boat, but the river was so violent because of the storm and the height of the river and the rushing water that it capsized, and four young girls lost their life in that. And they keep trying to, they eventually just decide that they have to stop. They can't rescue because they almost lost another boat of children. So just decided to stop and wait. And they sent in, I believe it was a National Guard unit from Chicago, I believe, that came in eventually with a sizable boat to be mm-hmm. able to rescue them. And as they're carrying them away, the last group of children out of the home, the porch that they had all been standing on collapsed as they're pulling away from the house.
It's like a movie scene, isn't it?
Right.
Now, of course, life does go on even during a natural disaster. Babies born in a crowded courthouse. I thought that was interesting.
That's right. Well, life goes on. So, yes, this was one of the refuge centers in Terre Haute, I believe this was. And so all of these people are, camped out waiting for the water to go down. And there happened to be six women who were ready to deliver their babies when the storm hit. And they all, I think there were six babies that were delivered, and all babies and the mothers were doing fine. So that was one of the, nicer stories. Although I don't think I would want to deliver a baby in those conditions.
Of course, that's a story passed on through the generations, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah, your great-grandmother was born, or your great-grandfather was born.
Right.
During the flood of 1913. Now, there are also, like you said, incredible tragedies. Entire families found drowned in their homes. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing.
Yeah, that's right. And so many stories like that. And it's one thing that's interesting, though, is trying to follow these stories in the newspapers that were printed at the time. And there's stories of people who are missing, people that were noted as having drowned and or being missing and assumed drowned. But then a lot of people were found later. They had, made it to high ground somewhere. Mm-hmm. So have some happy endings. But certainly in Brookville, Indiana, there was a terrible story of one family that lost, I believe it was eight members of all from one family. The funeral service for that was something that was retold in the newspapers about how that was such a tragic event, and the caskets, sure. Just vivid detail of what it was like to see this happen in their community and to have known these people so well and attend their funeral.
Of course, this is before radio and television and mass communication. The newspapers did a great job of reporting on this flood. I mean, they had to get out into the floodwaters to find these stories.
That's right. That's right. And it was very difficult to get there.
Sure.
They had to, you know, they would bring trains in. People would who were trying to help with the refugees and to bring supplies or whatever. They would back trains into the city, and then there would be boats there waiting to take them in. But yeah, to try to get in there. And even President Wilson, he's trying to get information about what's needed and what really are the conditions there on the ground. And had to send his Secretary of War in by boat. And the telegraph system was down. That's another thing that really came to light with the 1913 flood was the inefficiencies of the our communication system at the time, and thinking about should this become a national communication system.
Seems like there's always lessons learned from every disaster.
That's right. That's right.
Now there was a report too of a couple found dead. They had tied themselves together not to be separated in the floodwaters.
Right.
That's very graphic as well. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to Peru, Indiana. Tell me about the landscape in Peru, a lot, river community?
That's right. Right on the Wabash River, and also one of the places that the Wabash and Erie Canal came through. So that's, where this town or how this town came to be, right? This was an exciting place to build a new town. But they were on the Wabash River and in the canal as well. So when the flood hit, they were quite devastated. And really interesting situation there because of the circus that was there.
Right? It was the winter home for the circus.
And so, yeah, the stories that come out of that are quite tragic. And some of the photographs I decided not to include in the book because there's one of an elephant who died, had drowned in the flood, and somebody sitting on top
of it. I've seen
that
picture.
Yes, that's a really popular picture, but it's heartbreaking to an animal lover for me to see something like that. And they tell about the noise that was coming from the circus, the sounds of all the animals, gunshots going off. I don't know if someone was trying to put them out of their misery.
Well, if they were in cages, they couldn't let them out.
Right, right. We're talking lions and tigers
and
elephants.
Sure, yeah, you just can't let them roam on their own.
Right. But I think that they did let the elephants out a lot. Those that they could get to, they let them out. And one account says that they found several of them dead, that they had drowned, but a few others they were missing. Mm-hmm. And they just assumed they were out there roaming around somewhere. But I never heard any follow-up stories about somebody finding an elephant. I would think that would be hard to miss.
Because the elephants were lost. I think some show horses were lost. And lions and tigers were also drowned in the flood of 1913 in Peru, Indiana. Now, when doing all this research, what stories really impacted you? These personal stories.
Well, I guess so many of the human stories, that we've mentioned, the people that the orphans drowning, the families who were drowned, or families who lost their homes, so much devastation and so much loss, and to try to recover from that.
No insurance,
that's right. Flood insurance was not something that was around back in 1913.
So these families really had to start from scratch again.
That's right.
With nothing.
That's right. And you look at the reports of people, there are these relief funds in every community. Mm-hmm. They started a relief fund and people would contribute from, a quarter if they had it, or, maybe $100 or maybe $500. And so people, the communities all came together and tried to help everyone. So they didn't have a formal insurance, but they had, if you will, a social, backdrop for everybody, and everybody wanted to pitch in to help. But still, you can only do so much, and when you're starting over from the beginning, and you've lost everything, all of your furniture is ruined, and you maybe escaped with the clothes on your back.
Was there an immediate state and federal response?
There was. Certainly, local was very quick. Federal was quick to pay attention, but getting relief to these places took a while because of the flood conditions. I mean, these flood conditions went on for a couple of weeks before the waters even receded in many places. And then railroad tracks were devastated in so many places. You could not get through.
We're talking about the aftermath of the flood of 1913, concerns about diseases, and, of course, a lot of homelessness going on. People lost their jobs and lost incomes. So one Evansville newspaper did try to improve the mood of the community with something called a Smile Club. Tell me about the Smile Club, Nancy.
Well, that was an interesting response to the flood.
I think it was Evansville Press that came up with that.
That's right. It was the Evansville Press, and I actually have a copy of that right here. Just really putting an optimistic spin on, how would be the appropriate way to respond to this flood, right?
What were some of the suggestions?
Well, one thing was, put a smile on your face. Don't frown. Put a smile on your face and just become determined that 1913 is going to be your best year.
Well, that is optimistic. Well, maybe that's the attitude we should have about this pandemic. This is going to be 2021 is going to be your best year after the pandemic.
Sure.
It's our own little smile club going on here. So did it work?
Well, certainly time went on, didn't it? Mm-hmm. And Evansville did recover. I'm sure there were businesses that didn't come back after the flood, but many businesses did.
I'm sure some businesses probably thrived after the flood because they had to provide new equipment and they had to replace items that were destroyed.
Right. There were many opportunities that came out of this flood. So, and many businesses did advertise that they this was an opportunity for them. If they were selling rugs, let's
sure.
put rugs on sale because everybody needs a new rug now that it's been ruined by the floodwater. So in the newspapers, along with stories about the flood, then there were all of these business advertisements about, how can we help you recover?
My guest is Nancy Germano, author of Indiana and the Great Flood of 1913. Coming up, we'll learn more about Nancy, where she grew up, and what led her to study the relationship between human behavior and the environment. And did the 1913 flood prepare the state for the next big flood in 1937? I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. We'll be right back. Welcome back to 2 Main Street. I'm David James, and if you are just joining us, my guest is Nancy Germano, Butler University professor and author of Indiana and the Great Flood of 1913. Now, your research for your PhD in history from IU focused on flooding and environmental history in the Midwest. Do you conclude there's a history of settlement and development that made this flood and others even worse?
Yes, I do. Yes, I definitely do. I think there is this real interconnectedness between human beings and the landscape. We really have this interdependent relationship. And anytime we modify that environment, it's going to have an effect. And so realizing that humans are not the masters of that landscape, but instead we have this interdependent relationship is very important.
Now, where did you grow up, Nancy?
I grew up in Indianapolis.
Right. Were you a river person? Did you live along the river, or did you enjoy the river?
I did rivers? Not grow up along the river. I grew up on the south side of Indianapolis. We did have a creek running beside our house, and I spent a lot of time playing along the creek. I enjoyed the water. I also, went to Lake Wawasee every summer. So definitely like being around water, but not a river person per se.
Did your family enjoy the great outdoors?
Yes. Yes, we did. Like I said, went to Lake Wawasee, did a lot of fishing and swimming.
So have you always been interested in environmental issues? Has that always been part of your passion?
Not that I realized. Mm-hmm. I think I've always been a nature lover and enjoyed being outside. But it wasn't until I went to IUPUI, working on my master's degree in public history, and took a environmental history course at IUPUI that I really fell in love with this line of study. Before I took the course, I didn't even know what environmental history was. What is environment? Never heard of such a thing. How can the environment have a history, right? But it certainly does. And when you look back at this relationship that people have with the environment, you can see the...
And it's always changing, too.
That's right. That's right. Ideas about our relationship with nature have certainly changed over time.
Of course, the climate change debate is certainly still raging on. Any thoughts on the climate change, Nancy Germano?
Certainly. I believe in climate change. I know some people do not, but I believe in climate change and that it has – I think that there have been climate changes in the past as well, but this one is certainly sped up and been exacerbated in the 20th century and beyond because of human actions and the impact. And so we definitely have a tie, we being humans, a tie to what is going on with climate change now. And it's just going to make disasters like the 1913 flood continue to occur and continue to become more devastating in the future as storms become more unpredictable. As sea levels rise, we're going to continue to have these kinds of disasters. And so thinking about that past history and any lessons that we can learn from that, I think are really important to do.
What are your students concerned about?
They are very concerned about climate change and the future of the world that they live in. This is a topic that comes up in every conversation with them, whether I'm specifically teaching an environmental history class or not. Climate change is important to them. They recognize that this is their future, mm-hmm. and that something needs to be done.
What any immediate lessons learned from the Great Flood of 1913? Did the state take any dramatic actions right after the flood?
There weren't any immediate actions. It takes a while for legislation to get passed.
Of course, the lawmakers had to get back to Indianapolis, too, which
that's
was difficult.
Right. There was not any real immediate changes that occurred other than, rebuilding the levees, right? There was a lot of repair work that needed to be done. And so they were concerned with, appropriations and getting those kinds of measures passed so that they could do that kind of work. It wasn't until later, after the 1937 flood, that I think mindsets started to change and thinking about these bigger projects, getting the Army Corps of Engineers involved and, how can we create multi-purpose type projects that, will help with flood control, but also, regulate the water supply, provide recreational opportunities. So we're talking about the reservoirs that we know today in Indiana's landscape, which were, of course, not there originally. But those types of projects came later in the 20th century.
You mentioned reservoirs. I know Dayton, Ohio was really devastated by the flood of 1913. And that city really took some action right away and built like a reservoir system around the community. And they really survived the 1937 flood.
That's right. Yeah. And that was a community-driven project, too. So they didn't wait for the legislators to approve something and to get federal funding or state funding.
Really?
They all pitched in together and built. They hired an engineer and they built a levee system and really did it themselves.
So there was a model community, really, in flood control.
Right. Quite impressive.
Definitely. Now, are we prepared for the next great flood, Nancy, do you think?
Well, I hate to sound pessimistic, but I don't think that we are. I think that the next big flood is just going to be even more devastating, you know, as we just keep developing and building. And so the more you develop and build, the more costly the next disaster is going to be, right? You lose even more.
And we just don't know about the severity of these storms either.
No, we don't. We really don't. And you can buy flood insurance now that can help, but that is really just a monetary thing, and it doesn't cover everything either. There's a number of issues with flood insurance. And another important issue with flood insurance is that a lot of people don't want to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. There are certain communities, if you live in a floodplain, where if you have a federally backed mortgage, you have to buy flood insurance as well. But there are a lot of ways around that. And people who rent don't have to buy flood insurance. And people who aren't in a floodplain don't have to buy flood insurance. And so many of them don't. After a flood, there's a book, maybe I shouldn't have brought this up because I can't remember the title of it right now, but there's a saying that nothing sells flood insurance like a flood.
True.
Right. But even when people buy flood insurance, then they can let it lapse after a few.
Sure.
Months, right? You can just let it say, I really can't. This doesn't really fit into our household budget. And that's also partly how I became interested in this topic. I had to come up with a topic for a paper when I was working on my master's degree. And my house in Meridian Kessler in Indianapolis flooded in 2003 and 2004, 2 years back to back, not in a floodplain, not anywhere near the river. And our basement was flooded and we lost quite a few valuables. And that's kind of how I got this idea of, I've always liked being around water. I love the rivers and streams and lakes and all this, but water can be really devastating when it gets into your house. And so that's how I became interested in the topic. I'm not in a floodplain, not required to buy flood insurance, and yet our house flooded. So,
wow, how did that happen? Was it the sewer back up or just?
Yes, it was the sewer backed up. And in Indianapolis, like so many other cities, they have a combined storm and sewer system, which they're working right now to try to upgrade the sewer system in Indianapolis.
Now, you have some incredible photographs in the book and some old maps and other archival items. Where did you come up with all these gems?
Well, in the archives, of course, the historical societies, the Indiana Historical Society, and also many of the county historical societies across the state have these gems in them if you just go and look. Interesting story about that, though, was that I was working on this book during or right after COVID-19 hit. So many of the historical societies, the libraries, archives all closed down because I'm trying to get this book together.
Sure.
But so a lot of these institutions do have their archival materials online now. And so I was able to find a lot of things that way.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure there are things that you couldn't put in the book, too. You probably have this wealth of facts and information you have to weed through.
That's right. I really tried to just kind of get a flavor, mm-hmm. and pull a story or two about each place or on each topic and, kind of try to weave together these stories. But there were so many stories that I could not include.
Impossible. Each newspaper had a story about it and really some touching stories.
Right.
About these definitely horrific situations these people are in. Now you have this on the cover of the book, this haunting picture of these folks on the banks here of this river, mm-hmm. kind of watching homes washed away and livelihoods washed away. Mm-hmm. Where's that photograph from?
That's right, Main Street in Richmond.
That's Main Street? Oh my goodness.
Yes.
It's a river. Main Street is a river.
That's right.
Wow. What's next for Nancy Germano? Any more research or books in the works?
Sure. so many ideas. One thing I'm working on is an article looking at gendered experiences of disasters. So looking at, what differences there are for women who have gone through disasters like the 1913 flood or other disasters here in Indiana. And maybe, some of my ideas have cropped up in this book as well, making sure to pull out so many of these stories about floods or other disasters are centered around men's experiences. And so trying to pull out the women's experience. So that's one idea. Also, I'm working on another book that will look kind of bring the 1913 flood forward into the 20th century and what did happen as a result of that or where did we go from there. And so looking more at mid-20th century and the National Flood Insurance Program that was passed in 1968 and how ideas about disaster changed at that time in history.
Well, 1913 is an interesting year because right before, during the women's suffrage movement, it was really hot and heavy then.
That's right.
And that was going on. And of course, right before World War I, where women would really take a bigger role in society going into the factories and everything. So it's a very pivotal time, in history of this country, the 20th century.
That's right. Right. And during the, for a number of reasons, too. Think about the progressive era and people starting to pay attention to sanitation and think about diseases, learning about where diseases come from. And
the child labor laws were coming about.
Right. Yeah. So it's really a pivotal time the way people thought about society and their role in it. Ideas about cleanliness really are prominent at this time and trying to clean up the city and get trash disposal and waste disposal and sewer systems put in place and all of that sort of thing. And so then when this, these awful messes that are left behind by these floodwaters occur, people are really paying attention to whether you're cleaning it up properly and quickly enough and thinking about these places, these neighborhoods that had flooded whether they were healthy places to be.
That takes us back to Clara Barton, a woman who kind of, I guess, was a visionary of what was going to happen and the importance of communities being prepared for disasters. And I guess that is her legacy.
That's right.
Today, the Red Cross moving in when there's a problem. Nancy Germano, thank you so much for being my guest on 2 Main Street and taking us back to the year 1913, the Great Flood of 1913 across Indiana. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street, presented by Jeffrey Berger of Berger Wealth Services at Bayard Private Wealth Management. To boost the spirit of the community after the flood of 1913, readers of the Evansville Press were encouraged to join the Smile Club. Some of the Smile Club talking points: no lives were lost, and Evansville did fare much better than many other communities. Quoting the Smile Club editorial, "Why, bless you, dear people, we have no reason whatever to worry." The editor shares a personal story, glad his family is alive, after watching boats row by his home on Linwood Avenue. 6 feet of water in his cellar and a duckling in the furnace. The family, dad, mom, and 3 children, all okay, spending 3 days surrounded by water. And the news must go on. The editor rides a boat for 6 blocks to finally go aboard a streetcar. So join the Smile Club today. Be a live wire and break away from the bunch that frowns. Don't say it can't be done, and make up your mind that this will be the best year ever. This message from the flood of 1913. I'm David James, and this is 2 Main Street.